51. As my note had instructed, Mott, Tobias, Rodin, and Imogen were already waiting at the river entrance into the castle when we arrived. Connor looked surprised to find them there, but must have explained it away in his mind. He called to Cregan.
Take this carriage back to the inn and wait for us there. I don't want it here to arouse anyone's suspicions.
Have Tobias take it, Cregan said. He's not useful for anything.
Then he's not useful for managing a carriage. Get going. We must hurry too, because I fear we'll be late.
I led the way up the river. Imogen was behind me, then Connor, then Tobias, Rodin, and Mott at the last. Almost immediately, a roof of dirt and rock rose over our heads as we entered a tunnel leading beneath castle grounds. The castle walls were not much farther ahead. I had found this entrance myself at age 8. The kitchen staff all knew how often I used it to sneak in and out of the castle grounds, but they liked me and never told anyone. I was finally found out when I fell into the river once and returned to the castle smelling of rotten fruit and moldy meat.
It smells horrible in here, Tobias said.
Nobody promised it'd be pleasant,
I called back to him.
As it grew darker, Imogen walked closer behind me. I noticed she kept one hand ready to grab my arm if she started to fall in. We reached the gate, which was in desperate need of a cleaning. The gate was clogged with large, rotting chunks of food and debris. It dammed up the water to a higher level of reeking muck than usual.
I'm going to be sick, Connor said, covering his nose with a handkerchief.
The smell!
I hid my smile, but do admit I enjoyed the fact that he was having a difficult time. I used the pin to pick the lock within seconds. It was an old lock with soft tumblers. Once I was king, I'd have to order a better security system placed there. We went through the gate, and after another few minutes of walking, I informed the group that we had passed beneath the castle walls. Now that we had come this far, we were provided a little light by occasional oil lamps. When servants came down there, they often had their hands full and needed a lit path. It wasn't much light, but we were grateful for it.
How much farther? Connor asked.
Not far. Here the path widened, and we were able to walk several persons across. Connor caught up to Imogen and me. Tobias and Mott were behind us, and Rodin lagged behind.
Keep up, Rodin, Connor scolded. We are pushing against time.
Rodin answered with a shout of surprise. We turned to see what the trouble was. Cregan held him by the neck with his knife.
Cregan! Connor yelled. What are you doing?
Our group widened into a circle. Mott had his hand on his sword, but he wouldn't draw it. Not unless Connor ordered it. And he'd wounded himself only 2 nights ago after I'd killed Veldergrath's man. He'd be a weakened opponent if he did have to fight.
Change of plans,
Cregan said, his mouth curved into a nasty sneer.
Your orphan boy won't be king after all.
I took a step forward and nodded at Rodin. But why threaten your own choice for King, Cregan? Cregan grinned evilly, then released Rodin and handed him his sword. Rodin didn't even have the courtesy to act surprised. He'd known all along that Cregan was following us.
You are traitors, Connor said. Traitors to this plan, to Carthia, to me. Why, Cregan? I'm making my fortune. Once Rodin's on the throne, he will make me a noble. Then I'll take your place as regent. Won't be long before I take everything you have.
Connor turned his glare to Rodin.
After all I've done for you, this is your repayment?
You'd have left me at Farthenwood to die, Rodin said stiffly.
I owe you nothing. Then I'll have no guilt in ordering your deaths, Connor said. Mott, finish them.
Before Mott was able to withdraw his sword, Cregan advanced with his knife and said,
Mott can't kill both Rodin and me before one of us gets to either you or your phony king. Rodin is better with a sword than you might imagine. I trained him myself.
Rodin arched his head.
And for that brief time I was your prince, you told me everything I'd need to know to convince the regents.
Not everything, Connor said.
You won't succeed.
Yes, I will, Rodin said. Only Cregan and I go on from here. Hand me the crown, Sage. If you cooperate, everyone leaves in peace.
Maybe Rodin believed that, but I could tell from the expression on Cregan's face that he had no plans for any of us to leave here alive.
Sir, Maud asked.
Other than Cregan and Rodin, he was the only one carrying a weapon.
I don't know.
For the first time since we met, Connor sounded weak.
I didn't expect.
We're at a standoff, I said calmly. Maybe you and Rodin will get one of us. But even with your small brain, Cregan, you must know that Mott will get one of you, too. Whether it's you or Rodin who falls, neither of you can win this way. Cregan's face fell. He had not expected us to call his bluff.
The stronger of us should be crowned, I continued.
Can we all agree on that? Rodin nodded. Hesitantly, Cregan and Connor did as well.
Then Rodin and I fight. The winner goes on to the castle. Do you accept the challenge, Rodin?
Your back is still injured, Mott warned.
Good point. If Rodin wants to make it a fair fight, then how about if I'm the only one with a sword?
I grinned, but nobody else liked the joke. Cregan licked his lips, savoring the idea of seeing me fall.
It was never going to be a fair fight, boy. Rodin's too strong.
Rodin looked back at Cregan, then to me.
Okay, the winner advances to the throne. Please give me the crown instead, Sage. I don't want to kill you.
Lucky coincidence. I don't want to be killed.
That infuriated him.
Stop making a joke of this as if I'm no threat. I'm better at the sword than you might expect, and I've seen you fight.
I removed the crown from my head and handed it to Mott.
Don't let it get dirty. Let me have your sword.
It's heavier than the prince's was, Mott said.
I locked eyes with him. Mott, your sword? With an obedient nod, he handed it to me. Rodin attacked immediately, while I was still facing Mott. One of the advantages of being a left-handed person who had been forced to train with his right, I blocked his advance with my left hand, then rotated toward him and struck him hard at his weaker side. Rodin stumbled back with an expression of surprise at my abilities, but he quickly advanced again and swung harder at me. He'd improved significantly since I last fought him, and those were only in practices. This time, his blows were intended to kill, and he watched for me to make even the tiniest mistake.
You were faking before, he said, parrying my thrust. You've been trained to fight.
If you knew my father, you'd know that I was trained for show. He never intended for me to actually fight.
Rodin smiled and cut toward me, aiming low.
I'm still better than you.
Perhaps, but I'm handsomer, don't you think?
That took Rodin off guard, and I was able to swing around and kick him in the side. He fell to the ground but kept his sword ready. I started toward him with my blade. All it would take was a quick slash and this match would be over, but I hesitated. Could I strike after promising to save his life if he wasn't chosen as prince? Did I still owe him that? I backed up to higher ground. This match would not end with his death.
You could have killed me there, Rodin said, leaping to his feet and advancing. Why didn't you?
Oh, Rodin came to his own answer. He grinned as he engaged my sword again.
I should have known from when you stabbed Veldergrath's man. You don't have the stomach for killing. Unfortunately for you, I do.
Then he brought his sword down over his head. The force of his blade crashing against mine set me off balance and I stumbled down the bank. In the limited space we had between the wall and the water, Rodin continued edging me toward the river. I didn't like the idea of falling in. I'd lose the sword fight and possibly my life. Also, I'd end up smelling really bad. Our blades moved faster and harder, but Rodin's confidence was unshakable. If Cregan had chosen him for his natural ability, then he had chosen well. I wished Rodin could be on my side after this, because he'd make an excellent captain of the guard. Finally, my boot hit on a rock, throwing me off balance, and Mott's sword fell from my hand. I dove for it, but it slid into the river. Behind us, Cregan laughed, sensing victory.
Rodin lowered his sword and walked up to me, his blade near my throat. I arched my head and backed into a squatting position, but the blade followed me. "Do you offer mercy?" I asked. "If you accept that I win this challenge, if you concede that I win and give me that crown, then you and the others may go in peace. That is the mercy I offer. I am Prince Jaren." "If you were Jaren, then you'd never fall for a simple trick like this." I flung my leg to the side and swept it beneath Rodin's feet. He landed on his back with a hoarse groan. I grabbed the rounded edge of the blade and wrenched it from his grasp, then stood and aimed it at his throat. Rodin closed his eyes. "It's what you said you would do on your very first day," he mumbled. "Beg mercy and trick your opponent. I'd forgotten."
"No!" Cregan yelled. "Not him!"
He ran at me with his knife outstretched. Mott stepped between us and grabbed his hand, twisting it behind his back. To regain his balance, Cregan clutched at the crown in Mott's other hand. Mott stabbed him in the back with the knife and Cregan fell into the water, pulling the crown in with him as well. Blood seeped through the water as both the crown and Cregan's body were carried away downstream.
"I surrender," Rodin said, lowering his head. "Do what you must."
I placed a hand on his shoulder and pulled my sword away. "I'd have brought you with me into the court, Rodin. We could have been friends." Rodin shook his head.
"I don't need friends. All I wanted was the throne. Please, just kill me here."
My words had been sincere, and it was difficult to remove my hand. "Go away, then. Run and never find me again." Rodin looked up at me in an attempt to determine whether it was another trick, but I motioned with my head for him to leave and lowered the sword. Wordlessly, Rodin scrambled to his feet and ran out of the tunnel. His footsteps echoed in the tunnel until he'd gotten too far for us to hear him anymore.
"The crown,"
Connor said, standing near the edge of the dark water.
"There's a chance it'll get carried on Cregan's body back to the gate," Tobias said.
"It's probably sunk already," Connor said.
"Let me try to find it," Tobias turned to me. "Sage, when you are king, let me be one of your servants."
"Be my friend instead," I said.
"Go find the crown."
Tobias bowed and ran back down the river. Above us, we could hear the faint tolling of bells.
"The meeting's begun,"
Connor shouted.
"We have to hurry. There's only minutes to spare."
I started forward, then gasped and stumbled to my knees.
"You're hurt?"
Mott cried, then called to Connor.
"Wait!"
"I can help him."
Imogen didn't flinch in the moment of Connor's and Mott's shock at hearing her speak, but continued.
"You two secure the kitchen and stall the meeting. I can get Sage there."
Connor's strained voice revealed the panic he felt.
"Sage?"
"Just get to that meeting." I looked directly at Mott.
"Go now!"
Mott nodded and took Connor's arm.
"Sir, Prince Jaren will be there. Let's go."
"I will get there in time," I told Connor. "Have Mott secure the kitchen for us." They ran ahead, and Imogen knelt beside me asking,
"You knew about Rodin and Cregan? How?"
It was their last chance to make Rodin the prince. She reached for the hem of her skirt, intending to tear off strips for a bandage.
"Where are you hurt?"
"Nowhere. Everything's fine, really." I smiled and held out my arms to prove it to her. "I just needed a reason to get separated from Connor. Do you think Mott has secured the kitchen yet?"
"I don't know. I don't understand. You faked that injury?"
"I've got to go now. There's not much time left." I stood to leave, but she grabbed my arm.
"Your crown."
"I won't need it."
"Sage."
"Will you make me one promise, Imogen?" She pressed her lips together, then said,
"What is it?"
This was harder to ask than I'd expected, but I forced the words out.
"Next time we meet, things will be different. Will you try to forgive me?" "Forgive you for what? Becoming the prince? Because I understand now why you're doing it."
"No, you don't, but you will. If there is any reason to forgive me, will you try to do it?" She nodded. There was so much trust in her eyes, so much innocence. She had no idea what she was agreeing to. I kissed her cheek, then said, "Wait here until Tobias returns with the crown. With that, he'll be able to get you both through to the throne room." I wish I could take you with me, but this last part I have to do alone. Go then, and may the devils give you clearance.
The devils wouldn't be a problem. It was the regents I needed on my side.
52. A meeting of the regents was in full progress when Connor breathlessly entered the throne room. He was the only one who had come in late, and his arrival caused an unwelcome disruption.
If there were any occasion for you to arrive on time, Lord Connor, this would have been it.
The man who spoke was Joth Curwen, High Chamberlain to King Ecgbert. He was almost as much a part of the castle as the bricks and mortar, having served the king for his entire life. He wasn't a large or powerfully built man, quite the opposite, in fact. And yet he could command a room of 1,000 with just the wave of his hand. There was no one who had been more loyal to King Ecgbert, and few who had ever loved Carthia so much. The lines on his aging face told the story of years of worry and the weight of counseling royalty on their most difficult decisions. Now he was facing the greatest task of his career, peaceably finding a new king for Carthia. Because if civil war broke out amongst the different factions vying for the throne, Carthia's enemies would use the opportunity to advance on the country and destroy it. Connor gave a polite bow to Curwen.
My Lord High Chamberlain, I had trouble getting here. Forgive me, please.
There were 19 other regents in the room, seated according to their rank at a long rectangular table. Connor's place was near the end, but he hoped that by the close of the evening, he would replace Veldegrath at the head of the table. This was a vain and largely useless group. Few who had ever worked a real day in their lives. Even if they knew of the risk and expense Connor had undergone to bring a prince to the throne, they would never appreciate the valiancy of his efforts. Connor had accepted that it was his role to save Carthia, but this collection of stiff-necked, silk-wrapped snobs would never understand that.
You may take your seat,
Curwen said.
I have already made the announcement formally declaring King Ecgbert and his queen and son to be dead. In only moments, the death bell will toll, one round for each royal.
Almost immediately, the bell sounded throughout the castle. Their ring would carry beyond the outskirts of the capital city and would signal to the commoners that a royal had died. Three patterns of the bells would confirm the rumors were true. The entire royal family was gone. When the bells fell silent, Curwen continued.
Lords Mead, Beckett, and Hentower, who traveled to Issyl this past week, have confirmed for us that Prince Jaren must have died in the pirate attack 4 years ago. Therefore, we are left with no alternative but to...
There is something more to that story.
Connor's words were smug and tilted toward the self-righteous. This was a speech he had practiced so often in his head that he could repeat it in his sleep.
May I speak, Lord Curwen?
Curwen nodded permission at him, and Connor stood.
With deference to my fellow regents who searched for proof of Jaren's death this past week, they are wrong. Prince Jaren survived the pirate attack 4 years ago. He still lives. He is the rightful heir to the throne, and should be crowned this night the King of Carthia.
Veldegrath stood, pointing a long finger at Connor.
Then I was right. You did have him hidden at your home.
Only for his protection, Lord Veldegrath. Until now. Surely you can see how his being alive may threaten anyone else who hoped to become king tonight.
Is that an accusation?
Veldegrath began hurling obscenities at Connor. The two regents on either side of him held him back, and other regents around the table murmured loudly to one another. Finally, Curwen stepped forward.
So where is this prince of yours, Lord Connor?
He's coming. As I said before, we had trouble getting here.
Naturally you did. I'm told there were several Prince Jarens who had trouble getting here.
Connor spoke above the chuckles of his peers.
They didn't let anyone through at the gate. No doubt the prince will punish the guards there for failing to recognize him.
If he were the prince, he would have known how to get through. The royals always know how to get through.
He must have forgotten.
Connor's face paled, and he held on to the table for support.
But Prince Jaren will be here. Then you'll see.
hearing footsteps in the hallway. He turned to the doors of the throne room expectantly. Almost as if on cue, someone did enter, but it was not who he hoped to see.
"Mott," Connor said. "Only regents are allowed in this meeting," Veldegrath said. "You may wait with the other guests and nobles in the Great Hall. That's where the new king will greet his people."
But Mott seemed to see only Connor in the room.
"He isn't here. He came through the kitchen a long time ago."
"Perhaps your false prince is lost in the castle,"
another regent said, to laughter in the room.
"He grew up here. Of course he's not lost."
It was an attempt at confidence, but desperation cut too clearly through Connor's words.
"I propose we continue this meeting."
Veldegrath waited until all eyes were on him, and then added,
"We must not keep the people waiting, and I'm sure whoever is chosen as king will want to speak to Lord Connor on the subject of treason."
Then something must have happened in the adjoining room, the great hall where hundreds of citizens had gathered to wait for the announcement of the new king. What had been a steady hum of conversation suddenly fell completely silent. Behind Mott, a castle servant burst through the doors.
"Forgive me, regents,"
he said, forgetting the customary bow of his head.
"But you should all come into the great hall as quickly as possible."
Although they were 20 men and women of great status and power, well-trained in decorum and manners, no one would have known it by the way they hurried from the throne room. The only one who did not push his way out was Kerwin, who slid through a secret door between the throne room and the great hall. He was the first to see what had caused the entire crowd in the great hall to fall silent, for Prince Jaren was standing at the head of the room. 53. I was in no hurry. All that mattered was the order in which I completed this plan. I stood on the dais at the head of the room, the platform reserved for royalty, or the courtiers required near them in this formal setting. Behind me were the thrones of the king, queen, and Darius. Jaren's throne was no longer here. I wondered how long I'd been gone before it was carried away. The room was filled with a few hundred people, none of whom I recognized. But they clearly recognized me. I had come through a door connecting directly from the private rooms of the royal family. There was no announcement of my arrival, but apparently it hadn't been necessary. Their wide eyes in total silence while staring at me confirmed that. I saw Kerwin come through the door from the throne room, where he and the other regents had been meeting. Him I recognized. He'd hardly changed over the past 4 years. Still a powerful presence, and someone I'd always respected. From his expression, it was obvious he knew who I was supposed to be, but he seemed to be fighting his own eyes.
"Who are you?"
Kerwin asked, cautious as always. The first order of business was to withdraw my sword, the real sword belonging to Prince Jaren. Before leaving the castle 4 years ago, I had hidden it beneath a loose floorboard in my old room, accessible only by crawling under the bed. My room had remained exactly as it was the night I left. My sword was still there as well, and other than a thin blanket of dust, it looked exactly as it had before. I balanced the sword horizontally on both hands and knelt before Kerwin as he approached me. "You know me, Lord Kerwin. I am that boy who burned the throne room, the boy who challenged the King of Mendenwall to a duel. I am the younger Prince of Carthia. I am Jaren." A whisper passed through the room. Kerwin seemed unimpressed, but he was still listening. I stood, but pointed to a nick in the blade of the sword. After I lost the duel to that king, I threw this sword in anger, and it hit a sharp corner of the castle wall. You later returned it to me privately, and said that if I don't respect my sword, no one will respect me. Then you apologized because you had also heard what the king said about my mother, but you hadn't dared to challenge him. Kerwin faltered a moment, then recovered.
"Someone could have overheard that."
"Perhaps so, but it was I you spoke to that day." Without taking my eyes off his, I reached into my pocket and pulled out a small golden rock. It was the last gift my father had ever given me inside the satchel at the church. Since I stole it back from Connor, it had never been hidden especially well. Anyone who wished to venture high onto the ledges of Farthenwood would have found it. Later, I moved the rock to the bank of the stream on the outskirts of Connor's estate, where it hid in its careful place amongst a thousand other ordinary rocks. "This is for you." I pressed the stone into Kerwin's hand. Kerwin turned it over in his hands, unimpressed.
"Imitator's gold? It's worthless."
"No, it's real gold. I am real Lord Kerwin." Tears filled Kerwin's eyes. He pulled a creased and worn paper from his pocket and unfolded it. His hands shook increasingly as he read it. Then he turned to the audience and said,
"This note was given to me by King Ecbert about a month after Prince Jaren's ship was attacked 4 years ago. I was instructed to keep it with me at all times, and to read it only if someone ever came forward claiming to be the prince. This is what it says."
He read aloud.
"Many may one day claim to be the lost prince of Carthia. They will be well rehearsed, and some may even look the part. You will know Prince Jaren by one sign alone. He will give you the humblest of rocks and tell you it is gold."
Kerwin folded the paper again, and then said to the audience,
"Lords and ladies of Carthia, I present to you the son of King Ecbert and Queen Erin. He is the lost royal of Carthia, who lives and stands before you. Hail, Prince Jaren!"
Then he turned to me and fell to his knees. He took my hand in his and pressed the note into my palm, then kissed the back of my hand. In turn, everyone in the room sank to their knees and said, "Hail, Prince Jaren!" Kerwin looked up at me, and a single tear fell onto his cheek.
"Your pants are filthy, as if you rolled in the dirt before coming here. I would expect nothing less from the boy I remember."
I smiled. "I've come home. Do you know me now?"
"In a crowd of 1,000 boys claiming to be the prince, there would be only one with the same look of trouble in his eye. I promise never to forget you again."
Suddenly, as well as I thought I had everything planned out, I was at a loss. Should I tell them to rise or issue a command? They were all watching me, waiting for what I'd do next. There was only one person in the room who had failed to kneel. Bevan Connor stood at the back of the room, frozen. I walked into the crowd, which stood and magically parted before me. Connor found his words and spoke them slowly.
"It cannot be. You... I suspected it once or twice, but... was I blind?"
"You saw who you wanted to see, Connor. Nothing more."
"He sees nothing but a fraud, and so do I," Veldegraf said from behind me. "This is clearly an imposter."
I turned and smiled at him. "You are relieved of your duties as Prime Regent, Lord Veldegraf." Then to Connor I said, "See how I keep my promises? For now, you are my new Prime Regent." Connor didn't return the smile. He was still more frozen than not.
"You cannot do this," Veldegraf sneered. "Who are you really? I heard Connor comb through the orphanages of Carthia. No doubt he found you there amongst the other fleas and vermin."
"He did. I lived in several orphanages at various times, and went by the name of Sage. Trace my records back as far as you can. You'll find the first entry about 4 years ago, shortly after Jaren disappeared." Veldegraf laughed at that.
"So you admit to being one of them. Now you expect me to bow before you?"
I grinned. "You're right. That is funny." Then I laughed with him, laughed so hard that I put a hand on his shoulder to better share the joke. He didn't appreciate that, and slid my hand away, like brushing an earwig off his clothes. With my other hand, I lifted a coin from his vest, and then rolled it away on my fingertips. His laughter ceased, and another chorus of whispers echoed through the room. "You know me, don't you, Lord Veldegraf?" He rubbed his silver ring as the signs of anxiety washed over his face. I nodded at his ring. "I stole that from you once, right off your finger. You remember that, I'm sure. It was hours before you noticed. You told my mother I was incorrigible."
Apparently little has changed, Veldergrath muttered.
More loudly, I asked,
Do I have guards in here? Escort Lord Veldergrath out of this castle.
I flipped his coin back at him. Come up with any questions you may have to verify my identity. We'll meet again soon, and I promise that I will satisfy you. Two guards appeared on either side of Veldergrath. One took his arm and began to pull him away, but he shrugged them off and said,
No, your highness. Now that I see you up close, there will be no questions.
Then, like a scolded dog, he walked out ahead of the guards.
I have questions, a voice said, again behind me.
This voice I had also heard before. It was the one person I least wanted to see, though it was the most inevitable. The betrothed Princess Amarinda stood in the center of the aisle I had created by walking there. Her hair was much fancier than the last time we met, piled high on her head and full of curls and ribbon. She wore a square-necked, cream-colored dress, intricately patterned in gold tones and trimmed to match the ribbon in her hair. She would have already heard the bells tolling for the deaths of the royal family. I could only imagine the pain she must have endured this evening, wondering who had been chosen as the new ruler of Carthia, and what he would do about her. No matter what her anticipations might have been for tonight, one thing was certain. She did not expect me. I walked over to her and gave a polite bow. Princess, it is good to see you again. The hard expression on her face made it clear that she did not feel the same way. Aware of the many eyes on us, I moved closer to her and whispered, Can we talk? Her tone was icy.
Talk with whom? A brazen servant, a ragged orphan, or a prince?
With me.
Here in public?
I hesitated, and she added,
We'll make a scene if we're only talking. Dance with me.
I started to protest, but she was right. A dance might be the best shield for the conversation we had to have. So I nodded at the musicians in the corner to begin a song. With little attempt at concealing her disgust, she took my hand and moved with me to begin the steps.
The cut on your cheek is still there, though much improved from what it was before,
she finally said. It was never intended that you notice me that night, I explained.
Then you should not have spoken to me the way you did.
I sometimes lack the talent of knowing when to speak and when to keep quiet.
That's not true,
she snapped. Then she took a deep breath and fell back into rhythm with the dance.
You had every opportunity to be honest with me about the one thing that mattered most. It was no lack of talent. You designed it that way.
I never lied to you that night, not once.
Even after I begged for it, you failed to tell me the truth. Only the devils know the difference between that and a lie. You have hurt and insulted me.
I had no answer to that, and only said, You will never find me dishonest with you again, Princess.
I hope not. Neither to spare your feelings nor mine. How shall I address you now? You're no longer sage.
The dance step called for me to lean to my right. If she noticed me wince from the ache in my ribs, she didn't acknowledge it. When I stood straight, I could speak again. Call me Jaren.
You dance like a royal, Jaren. Better than your brother did.
Don't compare me to him. She stiffened.
It was my attempt at a compliment.
Darius and I are very different people. If you think of him when you think of me, I'll always be a failure to you. Her eyes fluttered, blinking back tears, and we fell into silence. We both knew there was more to be said, much more, and yet we completed the rest of the dance without another word. As the music ended, Amarinda pulled away from me.
What happens now for me?
Whatever you want, I said.
All I want is to be happy, she said softly. But I fear that is too much to ask.
My smile at her was weak and apologetic. I hadn't caused my brother's death, but I was a consequence of it. We'll talk later, in private. She agreed, though the look of disgust had returned to her face.
May I have your permission to leave now? I'm upset and wish to be alone.
I nodded at her, and as Amarinda disappeared into the crowd, I was again alone in a sea of strangers. Still at the head of the room, Kerwin said,
Your Highness, there must be a ceremony to make your new title official. I regret that your old crown is long lost.
I have it!
Tobias pushed forward through the crowd, holding something wrapped in a kitchen towel in his arms. He was wet and smelled horrible. I wondered how he'd made it this far into the castle. He stopped when he saw me and bowed.
So, you were the prince all along. Why couldn't I see it?
Then his face paled.
Oh, the crimes I've committed against you.
You committed them against an orphan named Sage. You've done nothing to Jaren. Tobias nodded and unwrapped the towel.
Your crown, my prince.
Connor was suddenly there beside him. He grabbed the crown and said,
I am his prime regent. It is my duty to crown him in the ceremony.
As we walked forward together, Connor whispered,
If you forgive me here, I will serve you forever, on your terms, Jaren.
I said nothing, although it did not go the way he had intended. Connor's plan was complete. Mine was not. 54. The ceremony to crown me king went by very quickly. Kerwin produced the Book of Faith, which Connor read from to administer the blessing of the king. When it was finished, Kerwin gave him a ring, which Connor placed on my finger.
This belonged to King Ecbert,
Connor said.
It was your father's.
The king's ring. It was heavier than I'd expected. Made of gold and imprinted with my family crest. It was too large and looked funny on my hand, like something I'd stolen rather than inherited through birthright. Then he lifted from a ruby-red pillow my crown, still wet from having been washed.
This is a prince's crown. A new one will be commissioned for you immediately, but it will do for now.
He placed it on my head. This time with much humbler and gentler hands than had crowned me at the inn. Connor went to his knees again and said,
Hail, King Jaren! Hail, King Jaren!
The audience echoed.
Be a better king than your father was, Connor said softly. You come to the throne at a time of great upheaval.
There is always upheaval, I said. Only the reasons for the troubles change.
You have the betrothed princess. She will support you.
She hates me.
So do I, and I just crowned you king.
Connor smiled as he said it, but it probably wasn't a joke. I kept my promise to you, I said, still keeping my voice quiet enough so that only he could hear us. You have the position you wanted.
You are the true king,
Connor said.
You may place me anywhere you desire.
So I shall. Then more loudly I added, I want the Prime Regent, Lord Bevan Connor, arrested for the attempted murder of Prince Jaren 4 years ago. Arrest him for the murder of an orphan boy named Latimer, and also for the murders of King Ecbert, Queen Erin, and Crown Prince Darius. Whispers and hisses flew through the room. Connor turned to me with panic-stricken eyes.
No, I didn't.
From a pocket of my jacket, I pulled out a small vial. This is oil pressed from the Dervanis flower, I said. It took me a long time to figure out what sort of poison might have killed my family. Entire nights searching through the books in your library. I'm not a great reader, that's true. But if the subject matter interests me, I can comb through books quite quickly. Oddly enough, I found the answer in a book in your bedroom. Dervanis oil is tasteless and requires only a single drop to produce a lethal dose. But it doesn't kill immediately. A person will go to sleep feeling fine and never wake up again. Dervanis oil is hard to come by. Yet this was in a strong box in your office. Connor shook his head. Then his eyes darted left, and he thrust his hand inside his jacket.
As I always said, Sage, if I go down, so do you.
But he failed to find what he was looking for. He drew back and searched his jacket. I released the cuff of my sleeve, and a knife he had hidden in his jacket fell into my hands. If this is what you wanted,
then I shall have to increase the charges against you. Two guards appeared on either side of Connor, and each took his arm.
I can't imagine the pleasure you must be taking in this moment, he said nastily.
My temper flared. Pleasure? I'm staring at the man who killed my family. Whatever I feel now, trust that pleasure is the furthest from those feelings.
You said you were my prince. Is this what that means to you?
I am your prince, but I am Karthia's king. You'll understand why, in the hierarchy of my titles, you must lose.
Why didn't you tell me from the beginning? If you had told me who you were,
then I couldn't have unmasked you. I'd have doomed my own rule, just as my family was doomed. Behind me, Kerwin sighed. Addressing Connor, he said,
What if Jaren had been only an orphan? Surely you couldn't have expected him to fool the court for long.
He didn't need much time, I said, keeping my eyes on Connor. He needed a prince only long enough to get himself named Prime Regent. No matter what happened afterward, he would become the controlling power in Karthia.
Well done, Connor said. Jaren was always described as a clever boy, but I underestimated you.
I started to wave my hand to dismiss him, but Connor quickly added,
You are guilty of crimes too, Your Majesty.
Facing him full on, I arched an eyebrow. Oh?
Even when you said you didn't want the throne, you were all that time plotting to get it. You lied to me.
Anger surged through me, and I didn't disguise it well. I leaned close to him and hissed.
I did tell you lies, Master Connor, but none of consequence. I was telling the exact truth when I said I had no desire to be king. If there were anyone, anyone I felt could take my place without the entire kingdom's collapse, I would gladly step aside. If I could return to be that boy you snatched from the orphanage, I'd leave now and never look back. If you knew what it meant to be king...
I sighed and shook my head. Of all Karthians, I am the least free.
And what of my freedom? Connor asked. Shall I beg for mercy?
Beg mercy from the devils. I spoke more calmly now. You said you would sell your soul to them for this plan. Your plan worked, and the devils may have you.
If the devils have me, then you are their king.
Connor spat at me.
I will forever curse the day we met.
Take him to the prison, I told my guards. He will be there for some time. Connor, it appears you will be unavailable to fulfill your duties as Prime Regent. Therefore, you are relieved of that position and stripped of your title as a noble. Once Connor was dragged out of the room, I directed the musicians to play. Then, exhausted, I fell into my father's throne. No, my throne. I was king now. The reality of that was incomprehensible. One by one, the various members of the audience came forward to greet me personally. I didn't know most of them, though I recognized several of their family names. They had been of little interest to me when I was 10, and weren't much more interesting now.
You have come home to a country that mourned your loss these past 4 years,
Kerwin said, standing beside me.
See your people celebrate you. Will you join them?
It wasn't that simple. I still feel like the boy in the orphanage, I murmured. I'm lost here.
But this is your home.
I traced my finger along a carving in the armrest of the throne. It was my home because my family was here. I'm alone now, and I don't know where to begin.
You are still young, Jaren. Perhaps a steward would be appropriate.
I'm king now, no one else. Kerwin dipped his head in acknowledgement of that, and stared with me across the audience. Quietly, he said,
Not everyone will welcome your return. The enemies at our borders will feel tricked. There will be anger.
I know.
War is coming, Jaren.
A fact I understood down to my very bones. Despite that, I looked up at him and cocked an eyebrow. But surely their spies cannot travel so fast as to ruin this night. There is still a little time to laugh. He started to object, but I stood and said,
They must see me laugh, Kerwin.
at least for tonight. With that, I walked into the audience. Again, they parted for me. This time, I saw the person I'd been looking for all evening. Imogen stood at the back of the room, looking very small and frightened. When I approached her, she lowered herself into a bow and remained that way. "Please rise," I said. "It's still me." She obeyed but shook her head. "No, I don't think it is." "How much did you see?" "All of it, Your Highness." "Must you call me that?" Her voice faltered. "I must." "Do you forgive me? Can you?" She lowered her eyes. "If you command it, then I will." "What if I don't command it?" "Please don't ask me that." Kerwin came up beside me.
"And who is this, King Jaren?"
I took her hand and led her to the center of the group. "She is a lady in disguise, just as I was disguised as an orphan for 4 years. She is Imogen, and her family has debts to Master Connor. She has fully repaid those debts to me these past 2 weeks, an expert nurse in care and compassion. Her father is dead. But using my power as king, I posthumously declare him a nobleman of Carthia. She is a nobleman's daughter and will be treated as such." Imogen shook her head. "No, don't. I can't repay this." I turned to her and lowered my voice. "Imogen, you owe me nothing. You are free, and I wish you well in life." I gave her hand to Kerwin. "Will you see that she is given a comfortable room and dressed to fit her title? She may stay as long as she wishes, and at whatever point she asks it, see that she is provided a way home." She smiled through her tears and bowed to me. "Thank you, King Jaren." I smiled back at her. "Thank you, Imogen. I wouldn't have survived these past 2 weeks except for you." Kerwin led her away, but when he looked back at me, I could almost see a new weight fall upon his shoulders. Difficult times were ahead, for Carthia and for me. But even pending war should never ruin a good party. With a smile on my face, I turned to the group and said, "Carthians, tonight I am home again. Let it be a celebration. Tonight we dance." This is Charlie McWade. We hope that you have enjoyed this production of The False Prince, Book 1 of the Ascendance Trilogy, by Jennifer A. Nielsen. This program was produced and directed by Cheryl Smith. Executive producer Paul R. Gagne. Original music by Cheryl Smith. Text copyright 2012 by Jennifer A. Nielsen. Production copyright 2012 Scholastic Inc., all rights reserved. Now, please listen to The Duel. This is not a deleted scene, but rather a missing scene that tells in more detail one of the stories alluded to in The False Prince. Several months before Jaren's disappearance, at age 10, he was known to have challenged the King of Mendenwall to a duel. Only a few people ever knew the reason for the challenge, or the impact the loss of that duel would have on Jaren's future. Never before in the history of Carthia had a prince so young been given a sword this fine. I brushed a finger down the wide fuller, almost in a caress. A circle of rubies was set into the pommel, and the quality of the dark leather wrapped around the grip was excellent. It was a gift from my father, intended to encourage me in my studies. I didn't see how it would encourage anything but my absence from the schoolroom. "Come, Jaren, kiss it already," my older brother Darius said. "Then we can give it a try." He held his sword ready, beckoning me to join him. I approached him slowly. "Father said I wasn't to let anything happen to this sword." "As if you ever cared about what Father wants," Darius replied. I was close to him now and shrugged indifferently. It was enough to get Darius to lower his guard. The instant he did, I rounded on him with my sword high above my head. He raised his in response, but the falling weight of mine forced his weapon from his hand, and it clattered to the ground. Darius chuckled. "That was not a fair trick." I laughed too. "You'd say differently if you were the one to think of it." Darius was older and taller than I'd be at his age, and although I worked to compensate for that with strength and cleverness, this sword was still a little heavy for me.
Hush! Darius pulled me against the castle wall. Someone's coming.
We flattened ourselves into the shadows. I'd convinced him to sneak away from our books long enough for a quick test of my new sword. He glared at me now, certain I'd gotten us in trouble. Again. But I wasn't worried. By then I'd recognized the approaching voice as belonging to the King of Mendenwall, here on a diplomatic visit. He wouldn't care even if he did see us.
I'll negotiate with Ecbert, the king was saying, but I will not consider the terms presented by his wife. Who is she to speak to me?
King Ecbert assured us his wife had an equal voice at the bargaining table, another man said, probably an advisor.
Still hidden around the corner, my pulse was already racing. Sensing my growing irritation, Darius placed a calming hand on my shoulder. I looked up at him, and he shook his head in warning.
She shouldn't be at the table, the king said. Erin is nothing more than a prettied-up barmaid. She has all the royalty of a gong-scourer.
Darius tried to hold me back, but nothing could have stopped me then from revealing myself. I trembled with anger. Not only had he debased my mother in the worst possible way, but that insult extended to my father, to Darius, and me, and to all of Carthia. The king stepped back when he saw me, realizing I had overheard. I hesitated too, for only a few steps behind was Kerwin, my father's high chamberlain. How could he have listened to all this and said nothing?
You should be at your lessons, Kerwin said to me.
I ignored him and turned my attention to the king.
Apologize for what you just said, or else.
Amused, he arched his head.
Or else what?
Or else I'll challenge you to a duel for my mother's honor.
The king looked serious for only a moment before he barked out a laugh.
How old are you?
I didn't see how that was relevant.
Nearly 11.
I deepened my voice as I spoke to sound older.
Return to the castle at once, Kerwin ordered.
Why? I asked. Is this king afraid of a child? That did the trick. He held out a hand into which his servant placed a sword. It was longer than mine, and the king could reach farther than me. He was also much older and stronger. Even with justice on my side, I was at a disadvantage.
The boy means no harm,
Kerwin said to the king. Yes, I do, I said. The king chuckled derisively.
I won't hurt him, but he must be taught a lesson in respect.
If I wanted a lesson, I'd still be in the schoolroom, I said. I needed both hands to keep my sword high, and the king raised his with only one. I struck first, charging at him with the intention of piercing his chest, but he easily parried that thrust and knocked me off balance. I fell on my right side, then rolled back to my feet. He waited until I'd raised my sword again, then clashed his blade against mine. I nearly dropped my sword, but compensated by turning my body away. No, that was a mistake. Never turn from an opponent. My fencing instructors had taught me that. I swung back and he knocked me down with the ease of pushing aside a twig. I fell hard on my knees with a growing ache in my side.
Have you had enough, little prince?
The king asked.
Not nearly.
Still on my knees, I swung at him, lower than he was prepared to block. And my blade drew blood from his thigh. I dropped my sword, shocked to see how much blood there was. Never before had I hurt anyone that way. Then I remembered an injury was exactly what I'd intended, what he deserved. The king cursed and kicked me onto my back. He held me down with a foot on my chest and placed his blade at my throat.
Stop this, Kerwin said. He's only a silly boy.
His father had better get control of him before he's something more.
The king pressed his foot down on my chest before releasing me and walking on. Kerwin stayed back with me while I recovered my breath.
What were you thinking?
He asked.
You know your father will hear of this.
I was already getting to my feet. You heard what he said, Kerwin.
How could you stand there and let him say that?
We need this treaty, Kerwin replied. You don't understand how delicate things are.
I didn't understand, nor did I care. Raising my voice, I said, You had the chance to defend my mother and all of Carthia. For the sake of a treaty, you chose sides with a dung-warded maggot. Then I picked up my sword and hurled it with all my force against the wall of the castle. It hit the stone corner and fell into the dirt. Desperate to escape him, I ran around the side of the castle. Darius was gone, leaving me to get in trouble on my own. I didn't blame him for that. As the future king, Darius couldn't let people think of him the way they thought of me. Fortunately, the cut I gave the Mendenwall king had been only a flesh wound, and he claimed to be amused by our game. But my father was furious. He gave me a stern lecture and orders to stay in my room until I apologized to the king. I told him I was prepared to stay until the king finished rotting away, and my father left in disgust. Darius snuck me in a supper not long after. As I ate, he promised never to abandon me in a duel again. I didn't tell him I'd already discarded my sword. Kerwin visited me the next day to announce the Mendenwall king had left, and my father was allowing me to leave my room. He acted like it was a favor, but I'd already climbed out my window early that morning and swiped my own breakfast from the kitchen. I started to leave, uninterested in his company, but Kerwin called me back.
You were right before.
His tone was apologetic and sincere.
I never should have allowed that man to say those things about your mother. I'm sorry I left that burden to you.
Kerwin then knelt before me and held out a bundle wrapped in black silk. He unfolded the cloth and revealed my sword, washed from the dirt, but with a nick in the blade from where it must have hit against the corner of the castle.
The commoners will treat this story of what you did as a fireside joke, he said. Let them laugh. I will forever admire what you did yesterday.
I thanked him and took my sword again, but as I strapped it at my waist, he added,
A word of caution, though. A sword has power to change the course of the kingdom.
He pointed to the nick in the blade.
If you do not respect this sword, Jaren, no one will respect you.
I nodded, humbled. Once it was strapped, he stood and escorted me from the room.
Go straight to the armory, Kerwin said. If you are going to wield a sword, then we will train you to use it.
An order I was eager to obey. I had no intention of ever losing again. And now, please join us for an interview with the author.
Thank you very much for this interview. I am so excited to talk about The False Prince. I hope those who listen to this audiobook are just excited to get some of their questions answered. I think I should start with the most common question I'm asked, which is where the idea for this story came from. For that, I wish I had this grand and exciting answer. The truth is, it just came. For me, my best ideas usually come when I have this element of story that I know I want to use. For The False Prince, it was this idea of deceit, fraud. Then I let that simmer in the back of my mind, and eventually it began to form. Not a story yet, but bit by bit, I knew there'd be swordplay, I knew we'd have a little romance, and a lot of danger. The False Prince was written as a standalone novel, but I knew very early on that I'd never be able to tell the complete story arc in my mind in only one book. So when I mentioned to Scholastic I'd love to see this as a trilogy, and then they liked the suggestion, I was beyond thrilled. As difficult as things are for Sage in book one, they only get harder and more dangerous in books two and three, and not only for Sage, but for many of the other characters you meet in the first book. The other most common question stems from a reference I make on the About to Author page to the song Guaranteed that Eddie Vedder wrote for the movie Into the Wild. I mentioned that I had a general idea for The False Prince, but my early attempts to write it just didn't work because I didn't have quite the right hero yet for the story that I wanted to tell. All that changed when I heard this song by Eddie Vedder. Some of the lyrics to his song say, I knew all the rules, but the rules did not know me. Guaranteed. And see, I loved that. I loved this idea that a game could be played by someone who's using an entirely different set of rules in order to win. And from that line, Sage was born. He came to me as this complete character. For those of you who already know the story, you understand how forceful Sage is, how complex, and how stubborn. He walked into my imagination exactly that way, pushing aside every other thought and demanding my attention. It was as if he brought the details of the story with him, because once I had Sage, every other element of the plot came together very quickly. Sage, for me as a character, is probably the most fascinating character that I've ever been able to write. I feel like Sage lives in my head a little bit all the time, which is a really great thing because I can be someplace and I'll begin to see it the way that he might see it. I think what makes him interesting to me is he's this composite of opposite traits. As tough as he can be and how thick a shell he kind of portrays to the outer world, really, he's very, very soft and very vulnerable in a lot of ways and more wounded than I think he wants anyone to realize about him. I think his natural instinct is to be kind of playful and mischievous, and yet he has a very, very deep sense of responsibility. And so once he finds out what Connor's mission is and why he's there, I think Sage takes that very, very seriously and understands he isn't going to be able to have this casual, playful life that he had thought would be his, that he understands there's a much higher burden on him now. And so I think Sage is playing with those two aspects of his personality, pulling against each other. Sage is very conflicted with his family. I think he feels very rejected by them, obviously. And yet at the same time, he clearly loves them very, very much. And he understands that what his father did to him 4 years before the story takes place, as brutal as that was, it also probably saved his life. And I think Sage is torn in what feelings to have about his family because of that. And so for all of these reasons, all of these opposites, I think Sage becomes very interesting, and he'll continue to evolve as things become more complicated with him throughout the series, that he's going to have to deal, you know, with his feelings, you know, about what kind of king Ecgberht was and what that means for Sage. And Sage will have to deal with what he feels for Imogen as a friend, and knowing that he is obligated now to marry a girl he doesn't even know, and a girl, in fact, who probably loved his brother and had intended to marry his brother. And so as complicated as Sage is in book one, it's going to be really, really fun as he continues to unfold in books two and three. Also on the About to Author page, I mentioned that some parts of Sage come from former students I used to teach in a high school debate class. I should be really clear, Sage is very much his own personality. I've never known anyone just like him. But Sage has two unique skills I did borrow. One is from a student who could roll a coin over his knuckles exactly as I described Sage doing it. He was so fast and good enough he didn't even have to watch the coin to cycle it across his fingers. It's actually a fairly difficult trick, but when this student would roll the coin, it looked as simple as breathing. The other skill comes from a student who is a brilliant debater and very popular with his peers. He was also a total thief. Nearly every week when we boarded the bus to go to a tournament, he would shake the driver's hand and thank him for taking us. While shaking hands, he'd steal the driver's watch. And he was so good at it, the driver never knew. Then before he left the bus, he'd say goodbye to the driver and return the stolen watch, which he claimed must have fallen on the ground. And unaware that there was this total fraud, the driver profusely thanked this sweet, honest kid who walked away with a smile exactly like Sage would have had. As smart and smooth as this kid was, he got away with this theft every single time. For the other major characters of the story, there weren't really any inspirations. I did have some very clear ideas in my head of what the characters look like. I know most of them well enough. If I passed them on the streets, I'd recognize them. I think most authors say this about their characters. I do wish a couple of my supporting characters were real. For example, I would love to meet a real-life Mott. He's one of my favorites. Like the supporting characters, the country of Carthia is an entirely fictional creation. I think it has a European sort of feel to it. But for a lot of the scenes, when I picture them, I find myself in the Uinta Mountains, not far from my home. There's a really important scene about two-thirds of the way through the book between Sage and Mott, where they're standing beside a river talking. I've stood right there, except in the real world, that place is a lake where my family loves to go fishing. I changed a few details to fit the story. My kids aren't there with fishing poles in their hands, but I doubt Sage would do much fishing anyway. He wouldn't have the patience for it. Another question I'm often asked is about my literary influences in shaping this story. I've always been drawn to stories about danger. Even as a child, my favorite books were those where the hero is in jeopardy. The greater the risk, the more I loved it. My favorite book from childhood was The Wolves of Willoughby Chase by Joan Aiken. I loved primarily because those central characters are in so much jeopardy. I also grew up reading a lot of mysteries, Hardy Boys and Westing Game at first, and later on books from authors such as Mary Higgins Clark and John Grisham. So even though False Prince isn't a mystery, there is definitely an unknown whodunit quality to the story. And from the mystery books, I learned how to lay out clues, to build suspense, and create unexpected endings. There have been other influences, too. Certainly Lord of the Rings was a huge series for me, particularly the way Tolkien handles the massive scale of war while keeping intimately with the central characters. I loved Megan Whalen-Turner's Queen's Thief series, especially how she uses historical detail to draw the reader right into the scene, and I felt Suzanne Collins was brilliant in Hunger Games with letting the reader believe that everything could go terribly wrong at any minute, and it often does. Finally, a lot of people want to know what happens next for Sage. I have to be really careful here, but yes, book one leaves off with Carthy on the brink of war, a fierce adversary in prison, and a love triangle forming between the beautiful Princess Amarinda and Imogen, the kitchen girl who helped Sage get through Farthenwood. Her backstory isn't going to be hugely explored, but her role in Sage's life, she's a pretty tough girl. I like with Imogen, I mean, there's so much that's happening there. You know, Sage is absolutely at a low point in the book when he's in the dungeons, and the fact that Imogen has taken the very biggest secret of her entire life and has decided to trust Sage with that secret, I think is really super significant. And I think it reveals something, too, about Imogen, which is, as clever as Sage is about hiding himself, Imogen is just as clever, that she's been living in Connor's home for years, serving him, and has managed to keep this secret. And so I think it reveals a lot about Imogen and who she is as a person and how she forges this relationship with Sage, because he's not trusting enough to reach out to her, but she has been able in her life to maintain that idea of trusting others. That is a really good lesson for Sage to learn, that there are people in this world you have to trust, even if it's scary. And so Imogen becomes a very interesting character, and Amarinda, too, is going to have a very significant role in the ways that the next two books unfold. And so he'll have these two very strong, very powerful girls to work with. So what's next for book two? I mentioned the impact of the song Guaranteed on book one. To understand book two, check out Eddie Vedder's song from the same soundtrack called Rise. I can say that in the next book, things get much worse for Sage. He'll be forced to confront his past, which will bring him face to face with a new enemy who has a personal score to settle. And there's an old enemy who is after Sage's life. Sage has to figure out who can be trusted and who is just as good a liar as he is. I'm already excited for readers to discover this book, and I hope they will enjoy it just as much as The False Prince.